This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to answer all of your questions about recycling. Can you toss ketchup and mustard packets into the recycle bin? Have you always wondered what to do with them? And what happens after those bins are picked up? We're going to answer all of your recycling questions. So give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. But first, seems like if you're going to test drugs that both men and women will take, and you're going to animal tests on those drugs, do the tests on those animals first for the drugs, you might want to test them on both male and female mice, right? But that's not always the case, because some researchers claim using female mice would bias their results, give less accurate, more reliable results, a claim that it turns out doesn't have much merit. Ooh, Virginia Hughes is here with that and other selected short subjects in science. She's the science editor at BuzzFeed News here in New York. Welcome back, Jenny.
Hi, Ira.
What's this, your first story about male and female lab mice and pain research?
Yeah, so this week, a big pain researcher in Canada wrote a commentary in Nature calling for more researchers to use female mice in their studies of pain. And as you mentioned, all other kinds of studies too, biomedical research in general. It's really interesting. Historically, the vast majority of rodent studies have been with male rodents only. And the thought was, well, female rodents have hormonal cycles that'll mess up the data. They're too variable, and we'll have to use too many animals to sort of smooth out that variability. But it turns out that's not the case. Some newer studies have shown that the female mouse and rat data is no more variable than male. But yet, you know, researchers are slow to change what they do, I think. And so most studies are still using mostly male animals.
Even though the research shows that male and females process pain differently, right?
Yeah.
Very big difference.
It's pretty interesting, both in, and there's many reasons for why that might be, but the human studies generally show that women seem to be more sensitive to pain or more frequently reporting their pain. So that could be for cultural, societal reasons. If women are just more apt to go to the doctor or talk to their doctor about pain, and maybe men are, you know, they feel like it's not macho to talk about being hurt. But it seems like there's some biological differences too. There's these studies in mice and rats have shown differences in what cells in the spinal cord process pain. And so it's tricky trying to kind of separate out what's driving these differences. And the idea is that we need to study both
of them. And the NIH now requires studies to use both male and female mice, right?
Yeah. In 2014, they issued rules that, with a few exceptions, any research, animal research that's funded by the NIH has to take sex into account in some way. So those don't go into effect until this year. So the research, it'll be a few years before we see that hopefully show up in the literature.
Now, I understand there's also been a backlash among some women in the science community who don't like that dual requirement.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. There are some researchers and kind of feminist scholars who say, hey, wait a minute. What this policy could do inadvertently is make researchers look for differences where they might not actually exist, or put a focus on supposed biological hardwired differences that are actually much more likely to be caused by cultural drivers. And so if we're looking for hardwired differences where they don't exist, that could actually backfire in the long run.
Okay, let's move on to your next story. It's about a recent cancer immunotherapy trial which had a few tragic deaths. Four of them now.
Yeah, it's awful. I'm sure you have talked about immunotherapy a lot on the show.
A lot.
It's, I would say, widely hailed as this breakthrough in cancer research. And one of the hottest kind of clinical trials in this area is now. So last week, the FDA halted a clinical trial of an immunotherapy because Well, at the time, it was thought that 3 patient volunteers had died. The company has since updated that this week, and actually 4 had died from brain swelling. So their brains, I guess, filled up with fluid. And then this week, somewhat unexpectedly, the FDA decided that that trial could continue. Mm-hmm. So after just, I think the FDA looked at the company's proposal for 2 or 3 days and then decided that it could go on with a change in the protocol, which is pretty fast.
Yeah, 2 or 3 days. The FDA never works that.
They certainly don't respond to journalists in 2 or 3 days.
Any idea why? Is there a bunch of politics involved here? Who knows?
Well, of why they switched it. I mean, the FDA isn't really giving many details about why, but presumably it's because they thought that the company's explanation of what happened made sense. Mm-hmm. So this particular treatment is called CAR-T. And what happens is you take a leukemia patient's blood out of them, you tweak their immune cells to sort of make them better able to attack the cancer themselves, and you put the blood back. And in this particular trial, the patients who died had all taken a very specific chemotherapy drug right mm-hmm. before the trial. So they think it was something about the interaction between that drug and these cells.
I see.
They're saying, we'll just stop using that chemo drug and restart the trial, and hopefully it'll all...
And your final story is about eBay, the place where you can buy, well, just about everything or anything, except now you can't buy human skulls. I was just going to order one this afternoon.
They're expensive.
Well, what happened?
So as of last week, if you had gone onto eBay and typed in genuine human skull, about a dozen different listings would have popped up selling these, in fact, genuine human skulls. Selling human remains is illegal in most states. It has a pretty bleak history of grave robbing, and it goes back a really long time. And bioethicists and others have been really upset about eBay selling these things. For more than a decade, they've been raising concerns. So this group of forensic scientists did a survey of these listings on eBay, and they looked for a 7-month period and found 454 listings of human skulls. Can you guess what the average opening bid was for a skull?
$100.
$650.
$650.
And one of them was $5,500. So very expensive.
They stopped it
this week.
Well, that's good to hear. Thank you, Virginia.
Oh, thank you.
Virginia Hughes is the science editor at BuzzFeed News here in New York. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. American fuel economy keeps on rising. In 2014, light-duty vehicles were nearly 70% more fuel efficient on average than in 1980. And one of the newest drivers is an improved fuel economy. It's not a battery. It's not a renewable energy technology. It's an engine innovation called direct injection. In 2015, nearly half of the new vehicles had direct injections, like fuel injection. And that percentage is expected to go up. Sounds great, right? Well, maybe not so fast, not entirely. Here to discuss the good and the bad of direct injection is my guest, Dr. Naomi Zimmerman, a postdoctoral researcher at Carnegie Mellon University Center for Atmospheric Particle Studies, author on a new research paper on the climate impacts of direct injection engines. Welcome, Dr. Zimmerman.
Hi, Ira.
So what's the difference between, I know about fuel injection, you take the gasoline, you inject it into the engine. But so there's direct injection, and what's the other one? What's the good
port
thing?
Port fuel injection.
Okay.
So in that case, you inject the fuel into the air intake, and it mixes really well before it gets into the combustion cylinder.
So what's the good thing and bad thing about this whole thing?
Sure. So the good thing, as you sort of implied, is that the new gasoline direct injection engines have improved fuel economy compared to the port fuel injection strategy. But the bad thing is that with the direct injection of the fuel into the cylinder, you can actually produce a lot more black carbon, which is a climate warming agent.
That is not a good thing. So black carbon, so you get more black carbon out of this.
Yes.
Is there any way to combat that?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a whole sort of string of things that can happen. The first thing you can do if you think about the pipeline of a car is that you can deal with the fuels. It's been shown that some components of the fuels may influence how much black carbon forms in these engines. And then when you get to the engine itself, there's a lot of work in the auto industry right now to try to improve the injection design to minimize black carbon emissions. And then after the engine, you can also put some after treatment on the exhaust line. So things like gasoline particulate filters, which may induce a small fuel penalty, could still be a means of balancing out this issue and making it sort of climate neutral or climate beneficial.
Mm. So how do you balance off the trade-offs? If you get a little more fuel efficiency, but you get more carbon, how do you balance out that trade-off?
Yeah, so that's what I was looking at in the study. It was just trying to figure out exactly how much improvement in fuel economy you might need to offset those black carbon emissions. And so if you are achieving those fuel economies that you need to offset that black carbon, then you're great right off the bat. And if not, then again, like I said, you can try to target fuels or revisit the way we inject fuel into the cylinders or put on gasoline particulate filters.
Can you actually shop for a car by, asking, hey, is it a direct injection or what?
I think it's not something that's not very well advertised right now. So most people, when they go to shop for a car, they're looking sort of just explicitly at the fuel economy. Is it good fuel economy compared to the car I'm replacing it with? And it's not really well advertised whether or not it's a port fuel injection or a gasoline direct injection. Certainly, it's something that you might want to ask the next time you're buying a new car. And hopefully the person selling you the car would know, or if mm-hmm. not, do some research online. You can normally dig up what kind of technology your engine has.
So your bottom line is it may save you a little bit of fuel efficiency with a direct injection, but you're going to pay for it by putting out soot, basically.
Yeah, that's possible, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Zimmerman, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Dr. Naomi Zimmerman, postdoctoral researcher studying air quality at Carnegie Mellon University. Do you know if milk cartons fall under paper or plastic when you recycle? And can you recycle a plastic bag? This is not a simple answer. We're going to answer all of these questions when we ask a recycler. Our number 844-724-8255. It gets pretty tricky, especially those little triangles at the bottom of that you'll find out they're not what they should be. We'll tell you why after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. When you're sorting out your recycling, if you're like me, you have a lot of questions. Can you toss hangers into the bin? It's metal. Do I need to separate out my yogurt cups? Should I wash them first? I know you have thought about that one. What about the bottle caps? Where do they go? Should you keep them on the bottle, separate them? But my biggest question is one when I'm done separating everything and the truck comes out to take it all away, where does it all go? What does it look like in the bin, where they go to the giant plant, the cans, the hangers, separate it out from the plastics, all that stuff? Well, Luke Raskin, our video producer, has answered that question. He's here to tell us all about that because he took a tour of the Sims Municipal Recycling Facility right here in Brooklyn. Welcome, Luke.
Hi, Ira.
That must have been fun. You visit, it takes in all sorts of glass and plastic from five boroughs. It's a lot of stuff, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's upwards of 800 tons a day. That's a lot. I mean, that's hard to even conceptualize. What does that look like? Well, it looks like an 80-foot-tall mountain of trash, of black, white, green, rainbow-colored trash. And when you get up close to it, it's all those mixed recyclables as well as a whole bunch of other stuff that probably shouldn't be there as well.
Well, my vision is like those, is that you have a lot of people standing next to a conveyor belt grabbing at things.
Oh, no. That's for the most part, that's not what it really looks like. I liken it more to being inside the digestive tract of a robot that eats recyclables. It's really, really mechanized. There's lots of conveyor belts. There's machines that sort for metal. That's a large spinning drum that has an electromagnet inside of it. There's machines that sort out flat objects like paper or plastic from the bottles and cans and things like that. There's disc shredders that break up glass. There's even these optical sorters, which are really, really cool, What those do are basically they take a picture of the of an item underneath them, mm-hmm. and they say, and they can actually tell the chemical composition of the item. And as the item passes over a little gap, a little air jet shoots it off. If it's something that is made of PET or HPT or wood or any other sort of material,
it's got to be lightweight so it can shoot it off.
Yeah, it just fires it right off, and it goes onto another conveyor belt. And there's conveyor belts after conveyor belts after conveyor belts, and they all lead to like what looks like an extruder of recyclables of all of one material, and they all get baled up and turned into these big blocks.
And then is there a market for them once they're in these big block forms?
Yeah, they all get put onto trucks and sold and shipped to people that are then going to break them down even further, wash them, clean them, and turn them into further plastics and things like that.
I'm afraid to ask this question, but because it's radio and it's not smell-o-vision.
Oh, yeah.
What did it smell like?
It was musky, but mostly the overriding smell, the smell that pervaded everything was the 3-day-old beer smell. So you have mayonnaise and tomato, whatever. You have all sorts of organics, as they call it, mm-hmm. and they all kind of ferment. And then there's, of course, lots of beer, and beer, I think, is the universal smell donor. It just pervades everything. So everything just smells kind of like 3-day-old beer.
It's a great video. It's on our website, sciencefriday.com/recycle, and you can see all these great machines working. But in the video, you mention that there is one bane of the whole recycling system. Something that gums up the works.
Oh, yeah. It's especially in New York City. So a lot of people live in high rises, and those people have, garbage chutes, and they don't collect big baskets or boxes of recyclables. So they put them in tiny little plastic bags. And then sometimes they decide, those plastic bags are recyclable, right? So I'm going to put plastic bags inside the bag in the first place. And then they put that inside of another
plastic
bag. You have a bag of bags inside a bag, and that just gums up everything.
Wow.
It's a recycler's nightmare because every day they have to stop the machines and detangle all the bags.
Wow, we have heard about the bag, get paper then, right? Paper or plastic, for the paper. Luke Rothkin is our video producer, and he toured the Sims Municipal Recycling Facility in Brooklyn, and you can watch the video on our website at sciencefriday.com/recycle. It's a great video, Luke, as always, and fun to watch.
Thank you.
I learned a lot from that one. We put on a tweet, out a tweet to test the waters to see if you all out there had recycling questions, and it turns out, sure, you're all very curious about what happens to your bottles and cans. Our next guest is here to sort out all of your reducing, reusing, and recycling questions. Darby Hoover, Senior Resource Specialist at the National Natural Resources Defense Council in San Francisco and former recycler working in a recycling center. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You ready to take questions from our audience?
You bet.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of questions first. We have bins at home and on the sidewalk, but how good are we at recycling? Are we, how much of the waste actually makes it to the recycling plant?
In the U.S., we're recycling about 34.3% of what we throw away at the municipal level, so we're not doing that well. We're recycling about a third of what we dispose of. That puts us about halfway in between other developed countries. So in Europe, you've got countries that are doing much better, over 60%. Some of the rest of the world is doing a little bit worse. We're right about in the middle worldwide.
All right, let's go to the first question from San Mateo, California. Evan, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me. Question is, I know that regular cardboard is recyclable. However, I was told that especially with pizza, once you get the pizza home and the oil drips off into the box, it contaminates the box itself and renders the cardboard from the pizza box not able to recycle. Is that true?
Good question. Darby?
It is pretty much true. And I will just start by saying that what is recyclable varies from community to community. So anything that we talk about being recyclable or not recyclable has to be caveated by saying you should go to the website of your local city government and check to see what is accepted for recycling in your community and how they'd like to prepare it. But for the most part, communities don't want pizza boxes in the recycling. If you've got paper that has grease or oils in it, that can complicate the paper recycling process. It's hard to remove the oils from the fibers. So for the most part, you can't put those pizza boxes in with your other paper recycling.
Let's go to Lauren in West Orange, New Jersey. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks, Ira. Thanks, Darby. you know, I've expressed with envy to a friend of mine in a neighboring town that they recycle styrofoam. So I'll bring my styrofoam from my town over to their town where I work. And she kind of laughed at me and said, well, we just stick it on a boat and send it to China. I mean, it gets buried somewhere. So I don't know if there's any truth. I don't know what happens to styrofoam for those towns that do say they recycle it.
Hmm. Yeah, what happens?
Styrofoam is actually a trade name for expanded polystyrene foam. And that polystyrene foam can take many forms. It can be that kind of big packaging that surrounds things like electronics. It can be those little peanuts that come into other kinds of packages when you get them shipped to you. And for the most part, it's air. It's got very little material in it, and it's a very large portion of air. What that means is it's not very cost-effective to pick up and take somewhere to recycle it because you're transporting primarily air. And once you get it somewhere where you can recycle it, you have to compress it down into a very small little brick so that it's more economical to ship somewhere to recycle. That said, it can theoretically be recycled, but because of those challenges of the economics and of it being lightweight and therefore very easy to become litter, many communities don't want to have styrofoam in part of their waste stream. So the communities that do recycle it are taking it, compressing it down, and selling it to other buyers. It's also true that a lot of our plastic recycling does get shipped overseas to China and other countries. That's part of a global market for recycling, and it's true for many of our materials. Waste paper is one of our largest exports from the U.S., for example.
Here's a tweet from Tweedledee who says, plastics used to make clear containers to hide the bruised fruit. Are these containers recyclable?
That's going to depend on your community. So if you've got hard, rigid plastics in New York, for example, you can put any hard, rigid plastic in your recycling bin. That's also true in San Francisco. Most communities don't take flexible types of plastic for recycling, partly for the reasons Luke noted earlier, that they tend to jam up the recycling equipment. But you do have to check city by city to see what's acceptable in your particular community.
Mm-hmm. What about the square, those triangles at the bottom with the numbers on them? How do you make head or tail of what they're for and how to use them?
So on plastic containers, you'll see on the bottom of almost every plastic container a little triangle that looks like chasing arrows with a number inside it.
Right.
Most people look at that and think, well, that means it's recyclable. It doesn't. All it does is tell you what type of plastic it is. So the number says if it's number one, it's PET plastic, number two, HDPE, and so on. Number seven just means other. So it's everything that doesn't fit in those first six categories. So all that does is say this is the type of plastic it is. You've still got to go and check with your city to see if it's recyclable in that city. And even then, some cities will further break it down and say you might be able to recycle number ones and twos plastics, but only if they're bottles and not tubs, because the difference in shape actually reflects the difference in processing that changes the melting point and means you can't recycle them together. So there's all these technical challenges with plastic.
So why do we even have the number and the triangle on the bottom if we can't use it?
It's just put it there to just help identify the polymer, but it's not something that is for the most part can tell you if it's actually recyclable in your community or not.
Okay, let's go to Steve in Mannion, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve.
I got to run, Pat.
You got to run, Steve.
Yeah.
Got to get on the radio.
I'm sorry. Hello, Ira.
Yes.
I love your show, and thank you, Darby. I play a lot of tennis.
Me
the
too.
The balls come in a can with they're plastic cans with a metal ring around the top. Are they recyclable? And also, what about the balls? I hate throwing them away.
Get a dog. No, that's what we do. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, what do you do with this?
There are actually some organizations that will take things like used tennis balls and repurpose those. So I would suggest just Googling for the area you're in to see if you have a large quantity of those, can those be taken to those organizations. And then the cans themselves are an example of a composite material. So they've got aluminum, they've got fiber, they've got plastic. One way to recycle that is to separate all those components. Another way to recycle it is to work with an organization like a tennis club or a sports organization that may be able to collect them in volume and take them back to a particular processor who can have a setup that can manage those. So we did actually do that with the USTA a few years ago. We were able to collect a large number of tennis ball cans for recycling specifically from the USTA and work with Sims to get them recycled in New York City. But that was something that's not typically available for your average consumer.
Oh, there you go. Let's go to St. Louis and to Donna. Welcome, Donna, to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here. My question is about the packaging materials that we are getting a lot more of these days, like in Amazon deliveries at the door or whatever, where in the past we were getting all the little styrofoam peanuts, and then it went to some sort of corn-based type of material, which was great because you could, you know, get rid of that easily by watering it down. Now they're using the thin plastic bubbles. Some of it's the small, you know, kind that you can pop, a little itty-bitty bubbles, but some's the larger bubble, air pockety thing.
Like a pillow, and yeah, those big.
Yeah, they're like little pillows. Yeah, which are great. I love them and I reuse them. But if I'm done using them, can I pop them and put them into the same container that I put, let's say, some plastic bags from the grocery store or something that comes in a plastic bag itself, like a new item in the mail that I get, like an outfit or something.
Let's get an answer. Great question. Darby?
It is a good question. So plastic film, again, is not typically accepted in most curbside recycling programs, but many grocery stores and other similar community outlets do accept plastic bags and other kinds of plastic film for recycling. What they accept varies, again, by community. Some of them will take that kind of plastic film. A lot of them will just take straight-up plastic bags. I love the idea of you reusing it. That's, of course, the highest and best use for something that you get like that, to see if you can repurpose it another time. And I would also just note that one way they could reduce the environmental impact of those is to include recycled content so that the plastic air bubbles are themselves using less material because they're largely air, but that material that is plastic could be made from recycled content, further reducing the footprint.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Darby Hoover, Senior Resource Specialist at the Natural Resources Defense Council and former recycler. What do you do with batteries? Like so many batteries everywhere. Batteries and the, you know, and CFLs, the compact fluorescent light bulbs.
Yeah, and these fall into the category of something called household hazardous waste. So those are not things that you're going to want to put in your recycling bin, and they're typically not things that you should put in your bin that goes to the landfill either. Those are typically treated separately to make sure that any hazardous components are kept out of the usual landfill. So most communities are doing some form of battery recycling. In many communities, you have drop-off areas at hardware stores, libraries, and other facilities where you can take batteries. In the community where I live in Oakland, California, you can take batteries and put them in a Ziploc bag and put them on top of your trash collection container, and they'll pick them up and take them to recycling. There's also, in many places, household hazardous waste drop-off centers, collection events, and a lot of different ways to get batteries back to the right place for recycling.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Daniel in Brighton, Mass. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
My question is, how important is it to rinse out your peanut butter jar or your jar of sour cream before you put it in the recycling? And is it really worth it if you're wasting all that water to rinse it out?
Ooh, good question.
That is a great question. You're going to not be surprised that I'm going to say the answer varies from community to community. The official guidance from the City of New York is to rinse containers before recycling. In California, since we're conscious of being in drought conditions, we're less encouraged to rinse out containers and more encouraged to scrape out or wipe out a container before recycling. So you want to get it as empty as you can, practically speaking. Mm-hmm. If you can use a little excess dishwater to shake it up and get it a little bit cleaner, that's great. You don't have to have it be sparkling clean. The issue is less usually with contaminating that container itself and more about having that food or that beverage that's in the container transferred to paper and other materials in the recycling bin. Might become contaminated. So usually it's not a hard thing if you've got glass or metal that's got food in it.
Scrape it.
But it does affect the paper.
Yeah, let's go. Last question to Jim in Griffin, Georgia. Hi, Jim.
Hey, hello. One of the callers already asked a question about the grocery bags. I was curious whether or not they actually got recycled. Seems like I remember hearing that there was a big hoopla of them not necessarily being recycled but being thrown in the trash. So if you don't mind, I'll ask a different question. If retailers aren't responsible, if the people that aren't profiting from things that are difficult to recycle don't take a hand or aren't made to take a hand in it, what about stuff like propane cans? And you buy a lot of different things from retailers, and they're profiting, and then you've got this thing that's going in the landfill. Seems like there should be more pressure on the retailers to take a hand and get it done.
Quickly.
I completely agree with you. In other countries, there are producer responsibility laws where producers of the items that most commonly end up in the garbage are required to finance and in some cases provide logistics for recycling those materials. We could have those kinds of laws in the U.S. We have them already for things like paint and batteries and carpets, but we need to explore the opportunity of extending those laws to packaging so that we bring that sector more into the responsibility for what happens to the materials they produce after they're disposed of.
All right. Thank you, Darby. Great stuff. Darby Hoover, Senior Resources Specialist at the Natural Resources Defense Council in San Francisco. And you can watch a video of the inside tour of the Sims Municipal Recycling Center in Brooklyn. It's on our website at sciencefriday.com/recycle. Great little video. We're going to take a break, and afterwards we're going to come back and look how racism can affect mental and physical health, and talk with a scientist who's designing a virtual reality experience to let us walk in others' shoes. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The deadly French truck attack is the latest in the horrific videos in the news and social media showing violence and killings. This month in particular, before last night's attacks, it's been videos of racial violence that have been filling up our news feeds. It's deeply unsettling to watch this stuff. And when the victims of violence look like you, like your family, your friends, your kids, well, it's even harder to bear. Early research suggests that witnessing this violence, even hearing about it, can take a toll on the body and the mind, especially for people of color. And the research shows clear links between roots of the violence, racism and discrimination, and anxiety, depression, psychosis, or PTSD. Some scientists believe racism could even be tied to lower life expectancies for people of color. So, what to make of all of this? How big an influence could racism, violence, discrimination play in mental and physical health? And what are doctors supposed to do about it? That's what we'll be talking about with my next guests. Dr. Monica Williams is an associate professor of psychology and brain sciences and director of the Center for Mental Health Disparities at the University of Louisville. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Williams.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Dr. Courtney Cockburn is an assistant professor at Columbia School of Social Work at Columbia University. Welcome to SciFri, Dr. Cockburn.
Thank you.
Let me ask you first. You've actually tried to measure people's response to racism. How do you do that? Is it hard to measure?
It's definitely hard to measure. I mean, racism manifests in various ways, from interpersonal contact, someone calling you a name or following you in a store, to things that you might observe in the media, as you're suggesting, some of these racially violent videos that we've been seeing. In one of our studies, we had people consume some of this media, and we monitor their physiological, psychological, and behavioral stress responses as they consume that media.
And Dr. Williams, you've done work on trauma and the ways lots of subtle incidents can build up to create symptoms of PTSD or other mental illness. How does that work?
Well, we used to think about problems like PTSD as being caused by a single traumatic event. And what we're now starting to understand is that often it's an accumulation of experiences that results in traumatization. And so something like racism, even if it's at a very low level, if you're experiencing it all the time, it can accumulate and cause symptoms very similar to PTSD, such as depression, anxiety, nightmares, avoidance, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Now that I have two experts like you here on the program, and considering what we saw last night in France and what other attacks the French people have gone through, for the citizens of France, how will this truck attack affect the way they'll react to, let's say, seeing trucks in traffic, especially kids like that? Is it going to have lasting effects, especially coming after the other attacks that have occurred in France?
Well, it's very normal for people to have PTSD-like reactions shortly after a traumatic stressor. Now, for most people, these effects go away over time. But sometimes they don't, and when they don't, that's when someone would get a diagnosis of PTSD. And so I think it'll be very normal for people who saw the horrors of what happened in France to be very jumpy around trucks and other things that remind them of the horrors. But given that many people also saw people being killed and mangled, the effect of this may not go away, and I'm sure many, many people are going to have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cockburn, what about racism or discrimination that doesn't happen to you directly, but that you see or hear happening to other people? Can that cause, you know, these health effects like we've been seeing on the news?
Absolutely. So we really refer to that as sort of vicarious experience with stress, in particular vicarious exposures to racism, which makes exposures to the media particularly important given the degree to which your average adult accesses media on a given day. If they're being exposed to these types of stressors and it is having an impact on processes that can have implications for health, then that vicarious exposure through media becomes an important source of stress for us to understand.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Williams, do you agree? I mean, there are videos of discrimination, violence. They're all over the place on social media, in the news. Does that make it worse?
Absolutely. When you see people like yourself, people who remind you of your kids or loved ones being victimized at the hands of people often who are supposed to be protecting us, that's very frightening. And when it happens over and over to people that you know and love, mm-hmm. that's going to have an effect.
How do you know when you are suffering from one of the effects of this exposure?
Right. Well, one of the things I often see is anxiety in the clients that I treat for this. They're often very frustrated, very angry, very sad, very hopeless. Their performance at work is often impaired due to these experiences, and they're not enjoying life.
Hmm. And how much a recognition is there among doctors and clinicians and psychologists of the effects of racism on mental health? Because is it in the medical journals like the DSM that doctors use to diagnose illnesses?
Well, we've had a lot of research done in the last 15 years, which shows a clear connection between racial discrimination and negative physical and mental health outcomes. However, most clinicians, it's still not on their radar yet, and we really don't see it represented in the DSM-5.
Mm-hmm. Not every racist event is something obvious, a name-calling or a violent act or something like that. What about the more subtle slights that people of color might experience just in the daily life? Can Dr. Kargberger, can you describe what one of those situations might be like?
Well, I think, you know, day-to-day life, what an individual might encounter, what has been called microaggressions, could be someone surprised that you were so articulate after giving a talk or a presentation at work, or shock that you didn't come from a single-parent home if you're a Black person, given stereotypes about Black families. But those subtle slights can also emerge in media. So as opposed to someone saying in blackface or using the N-word, you also may have a political pundit such as Pat Buchanan referring to the president as a drug dealer of welfare. He's not explicitly referencing race or Black people, but he's certainly using racially coded language or dog whistles to elicit negative racial sentiment, which can also, based on some of the work that we're doing, elicit stress responses and can be problematic for health.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 844-724-8255. Mountain View, California is up first. Paul, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. I'd like to bring up an analogous situation over in India where you have the so-called untouchables or Dalits who... they've been treated badly over, you know, over the centuries, I guess. They are the victims of violence, of discrimination. They're often born into lives where they have to do really menial jobs like cleaning toilets. It seems we almost have a caste system here in the States as well. But, you know, I live in Mountain View, and we have lots of Indian people here. I doubt many of them are untouchables. You know, they tend to be people who they don't have white privilege, but they have caste privilege. You know what I mean?
Do you see a sort of racism with new immigrants also? I mean, from India, Pakistan, things like that.
I don't know that they discriminate against Americans so much. I have seen some discrimination against Blacks. I don't know that Indians per se are the perpetrators.
Let me ask our guests, Monica, what do you think?
Well, one thing we do know is that racial or any kind of discrimination is harmful all over the world. Wherever you see these stigmatized communities, you see these negative physical and mental health outcomes. And I think it makes sense that most of the Indians who come here from India, they're not going to be of these very lower castes. They're going to be people who have more advantages. And so when they come here, they're going to bring their thoughts about advantage and disadvantage as well.
Do you see them as entering the, you know, the same kind of discriminatory, or being the victims of the same kind of discriminatory practices?
Well, they're certainly going to have their share of discrimination. I mean, the research shows that every minority group gets some degree of racial discrimination, but it is different for different groups. For example, among Asian Americans, there's this model minority identity, but even that kind of, those kinds of stereotypes can have negative consequences as well, and people don't always realize that.
Mm-hmm. Are there strategies that that people can use to positively cope when presented with racism and discrimination?
Yes, and that's actually been one of the areas of focus in our research lab, is how people do cope with racism and discrimination. And one thing we found is that some people tend to take a more challenge approach to it, like, okay, this other person is believing stereotypes about me. What can I do to help change the way they think of me and my whole group, versus negative coping strategies, which could be things like denial or substance abuse, or just internalizing those things and feeling bad about yourself.
Mm-hmm. Courtney, do you have any suggestions?
I think, you know, part of what we're considering is whether awareness and consciousness of racism is actually beneficial. So I think this is something that more research should consider as a form of coping. Does this sort of social consciousness, as well as social engagement around these issues, provide some degree of protection when having these sort of negative experiences? Mm-hmm.
I understand that you have a project in the works to use virtual reality to allow people to experience racism and discrimination. Tell us about that.
Right. We're really interested in whether we can sort of capture a more complex and subtle manifestations of racism in virtual reality to give people who don't normally encounter these types of experiences the opportunity to walk in someone else's shoes and walk through a space, a community, an environment where they would be exposed to some of these experiences. The premise here is that experiences with racism are so far removed from some people's reality that they don't understand it, they don't get it. And so we're wondering if we can, you know, leverage this technology to help people understand it in a way that they may not be able to really understand in their day-to-day lives.
Mm-hmm. See if I can get one more call in, a call or two before we go. Al in Minneapolis, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, great show. Quick one for you. I know this is kind of the angle has been more on the racism part of this, the PTSD, but I have a general question about the PTSD affecting the entire country. We've been under the terrorism, you know, umbrella for the last 15 years, and, you know, we get occasional events that are very, very sad and unfortunate, affect relatively few people in the scheme of things, but you've got the Homeland Security Department, you have all these things that are just thumping the terrorism drum constantly, and every time there's an upsurge and a flare-up like we had in France, which is just horrible, it's all over the news. People are probably all on high alert. Does that have an effect on the entire country's psyche and the entire country kind of just PTSDing up each level every time something happens? Or what's your thoughts on that?
Before you answer that, let me just remind everybody, this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Who would like to tackle that one? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Dr. Williams. So I would say that I think it definitely affects all of our psyches. I don't know that I would necessarily say that that's going to rise to the level of PTSD in everyone, but I think certainly there are social forces, and we have our own social psychopathologies, racism, for example, being one of them. And I think we're all affected by these events, and some people are going to be affected more than others, certainly based on their history and their experiences. But it does affect how we as a whole culture approach issues like this.
But as a physician, should physicians, psychiatrists expect or not be surprised or look to recognize this PTSD kind of that we're talking about when someone comes in and says, I'm just nervous, I'm upset, or expresses anxiety?
Yeah, people are coming in with these problems all the time. The problem is that our mental health care providers are not always looking for these problems and don't know to ask about them. And also people of color are sometimes afraid to bring up issues of race and racism because they're so used to being invalidated by other people who don't experience these things.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Carolyn in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'll keep it brief. I'm an African-American woman, and I just purchased a home in a fairly upscale area in St. Pete, and I think I'm the only person of color in my community. And while I haven't experienced much overt racism, I have experienced what I would consider instances of micro racism, where I feel like I'm almost educating the community. For an example, I was out walking my dogs, and a couple walked past across the street and pointed and said something, but I couldn't hear what they were saying. So I said, "Excuse me, what did you say?" They pointed to me and said, "Wanda Sykes." Because I wear my hair natural. And I thought, interesting. And my comment back to them was, "No, sorry, but I'm not gay." So I tried to use some humor, but it was just a little offensive that because I'm a black woman who wears my hair natural, they point to me and call some celebrity who happens to have the same hairstyle and say, "Oh, you're Wanda Sykes." So it's a circumstance where I feel like I need to do some education for the community there.
Yeah.
Because all black women who wear their hair natural, believe it or not, are not Wanda Sykes.
All right. Thank you for that call. Quick reaction from any of my guests?
I think that's, some people may think of that example and think, "Oh, well, it's just a, harmless comment about your hair." But what's really problematic about microaggressions and other forms of these sort of more covert manifestations of racism is that they accumulate over time. They add up. And essentially, they start to send a message that you are not as valuable, you're not as visible as other groups, right, that you are othered in ways that become problematic. And that becomes problematic at psychological levels and as well as physical levels that really are problematic. So just because it's a comment about your hair doesn't mean that it doesn't have any significance in terms of its effects on health.
Mm. Well, thank you, doctors, for taking time to be with us today. Dr. Monica Williams, Associate Professor of Psychology and Brain Sciences and the Director of the Center for Mental Health Disparities, University of Louisville. Dr. Courtney Cogburn, Assistant Professor at Columbia University School of Social Work. Thank you both have a good weekend for taking time to be with us today. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Luke Groskin, our video producer. Also special help today from intern Nicole Wetzman. Thanks, Nicole. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners at the City University of New York. And if you ever wonder what color sounds like, self-professed cyborg Neil Harbison has an antenna implanted in his head that lets him do just that. And you can read about his unique color perspective at sciencefriday.com/cyborg. And just a reminder, we have our video up there. If you want to know what goes on inside a recycling plant with Lou Graskin going to one in Brooklyn, it is quite fascinating. It's up there also on our website today. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.